Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Coming up on this New Year's Day, Ohio motorists convicted of drunk driving get a special license plate that tells other drivers about their crime.
It may be an inconvenience to an offender's family. It may be an embarrassment, but it does no way compare to what a family goes through when they've had a loved one killed or injured.
The Bush-Cheney re-election team gets their message out, opting to only go local.
73% of people who listen to talk radio are registered voters, so this is a group of people that will be very active in the public debate over the next several months.
Also, marching in the middle of the Rose Bowl parade and bidding good riddance, I mean adieu, to 2003 in sports. These stories and more coming up here and now. News is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Iraq, the city of Baghdad is on a heightened state of alert after a car bombing on New Year's Eve that killed 8 people. The explosion also destroyed a house and badly damaged a restaurant where foreigners are often the customers. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Baghdad.
Daylight made plain the magnitude of the disaster. Shop owners for blocks cleared away the debris of their shattered storefronts. The explosion that a U.S. coalition spokesman said was made up of some 400 pounds of explosives devastated Nabil's restaurant where holiday revelers had gathered. An adjacent house was ripped open in the blast that also heavily damaged the side of a hotel. Firefighters, medics, and U.S. military personnel all converged on what was Baghdad's worst attack in many weeks. The massive car bombing triggered a huge fire. A crater now lies in flooded streets. The New Year's Eve explosion is the latest in a string of strikes in Baghdad, but the magnitude of the bombing was on a different scale from those of recent days. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Baghdad.
Amid some of the tightest security ever, close to 1 million people gathered in New York City's Times Square for the start of the new year. With the Bush administration raising the national terror alert to orange, cities across the country increased security. In New York, there were more police officers on duty this year, and snipers were stationed on rooftops near Times Square. Metal detectors were in place, manhole covers were sealed. Police said that there were no reports of crowd trouble. The first passenger flight between India and Pakistan arrived in New Delhi today for the first time in close to 2 years. This latest goodwill gesture has increased hopes for peace between the two neighbors ahead of a weekend summit. Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
The arrival of the state-run Pakistan International Airlines flight from Lahore has been widely covered in the Indian media. TV reports have shown pictures of officials warmly welcoming passengers who arrived on the flight, which is the latest symbol of improving relations over the last 9 months. India cut transport links and diplomatic ties 2 years ago after an attack on its national parliament by Islamic extremists who New Delhi said were backed by Pakistan. 3-1, Islamabad denied any involvement. Since last year, however, the two nuclear-armed neighbors have broadened diplomatic relations and are finalizing plans to resume a popular cross-border train service. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
In Afghanistan, 3 U.S. soldiers have been wounded in fighting in the eastern part of the country. Several insurgents were killed. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, a top German official is quoted as saying the European Central Bank should resist efforts to cut interest rates. In a magazine interview, the chairman of the so-called Five Wise Men says that it's wrong to boost the economy with monetary policy and that a cut in interest rates could lead to inflation. New research indicates that Internet shopping sites have inconsistently improved their online performance. Keynote Systems reports that in the last week before Christmas, performance improved as the number of shoppers went down. Jason Lopez has more on that story.
10 seconds may not seem like much, But in the world of online sales, a slight delay in the loading of web pages often results in customers going somewhere else. Keynote Systems, a firm which measures web performance, says the best retail websites had a 99% success rate. That means only 1% of the time, customers weren't able to click through pages on the site and make a purchase. Keynote's Daniel Berkowitz.
We did see some very significant issues with some large retailer sites that at some point were at 80 or 85% availability, meaning that a substantial amount of transactions were at risk of being lost.
Industry experts say that services on the Internet will continue to improve, and as the web gets faster, more services will be launched. Throughout the process, growing pains will linger. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
Shrimp exporters in Vietnam have denied U.S. charges that they are dumping their products on U.S. markets. Last year, shrimp exports from Vietnam to the United States were estimated in value at more than $500 million. Ann Taylor, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is off today. It's Here and Now. Happy New Year. And if you're listening in Ohio, remember, after the stroke of midnight last night, anyone caught driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs will be required to put a yellow license plate with red numbers on their car, declaring them a DWI. Other states have or had similar laws, but Ohio's is the most stringent. Advocates say the plate is a way to save lives. Over 15,000 people a year are killed by drunk drivers. Those opposed say it's a scarlet letter for your bumper. Andrea Raykamp is Southwestern Ohio Executive Director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Hello, Andrea, and Happy New Year.
Hello. Happy New Year to you.
But it's not one for those drivers who, might have to have this plate in their future. Your thoughts on the plate?
My thoughts on the plate and Matt's position on the plate for Matt Ohio is that we believe that the plates are going to act as a deterrent and that hopefully people that have to have the plates put on will think twice before they make that decision to drink and then possibly get in their car again. So we're hoping it's going to be a deterrent.
Well, the law's been on the books since 1967. Apparently, judges rarely used it. Now it's mandatory, even for first-time offenders. How will it work? I mean, how soon do you have the plate on, and how long do you have to have the plate on?
Well, you have to have the plate on if you have a limited driving privileges, which is for occupation, school, or go to doctors and that. If you receive those limited privileges, then you'll have to have the plate on for that period of time. Once your license is reinstated fully, then you no longer have to have the plates on.
And about what's the average on that for that limited time?
Probably about 6 months, sometimes a year. It depends on how many offenses you've had in the past.
Well, you know, as you well know, there are people who are critical of this. They say, well, what about family members who have to drive the same car, or kids, you know, their parents will be dropping them off at school and they've got this shameful plate on. You know, even murderers and pedophiles don't have to wear some sort of tag saying what their crime was. Why should drunk drivers?
Well, drunk drivers use their vehicle in their crime. And so it's just another way to recognize people that are offenders and to possibly give an officer a second look at someone going down the road. But I can tell you, it may be an inconvenience to an offender's family. It may be an embarrassment, but it does no way compare to what a family goes through when they've had a loved one killed or injured.
Mm. You mentioned it may give an officer a second look. Is there's something about that, though, that runs against the grain of what we do in America. You know, everyone is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And so if somebody is serving a jail time for a DWI or doing some sort of public service, shouldn't that be enough?
Well, right now, many people have their license suspended for good. And with this special plate, it does give them the opportunity to have access to their car rather than have their car confiscated.
Mm, taken away entirely. Andrea, have you lost someone to a drunk driver?
Yes, my 14-year-old son was killed 22 years ago. And I had also had a cousin killed on January the 1st, 1999.
Well, I'm sorry for those losses.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
What would you say to somebody who finds themselves this morning a candidate for this plate?
I guess I would say that no one in this country can plead ignorance to the dangers of drinking and driving and to the laws. And so if they made that choice, and they made a bad choice, and have gone out last night and got arrested for drunk driving, they're going to have to pay the punishment. And if the punishment is having a license plate on your car, then so be it. I guess I would consider them lucky that they didn't kill or injure someone last night.
Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Raykamp, Southwestern Ohio Executive Director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. In the 1992 presidential campaign, Ross Perot famously predicted that the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, would create a giant sucking sound of jobs being pulled out of this country. Well, NAFTA eased tariffs on goods that move between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, and exactly how many jobs the U.S. lost because of it is still up for debate. But one thing's for sure, NAFTA, which turns 10 today, is back as a hot-button issue in this year's presidential campaign. This week, Congressman Richard Gephardt told reporters that NAFTA has sparked a race to the bottom.
In Mexico, manufacturing wages are 35% less than before NAFTA. 98% of what they make comes here. So we're not helping them. We're not helping ourselves. We are continuing to lose jobs to them, and they don't have any money to buy anything that they're making.
Not all the presidential candidates agree, but in 10 years of NAFTA, trade between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. has boomed, and so has the U.S. trade deficit. So what has NAFTA done for North America? On the line from Washington are two economists with differing views of NAFTA. Gary Huffbauer is with the Institute for International Economics. Welcome, Gary.
Thanks.
And Robert Scott is with the Economic Policy Institute. Hello, Rob.
Hi.
Well, let's start with you, Gary. Ross Perot wasn't the only person making claims about NAFTA that didn't come true, at least in full. You were widely quoted saying in its first year that NAFTA would generate a $7 to $9 billion surplus and 170,000 new jobs in the U.S. economy, the opposite of what Ross Perot said. But that hasn't happened either. Why?
Well, the main point I made at the time is that the numbers were quite small relative to the size of the U.S. economy. But the projection of job gains were completely wrong, and the reason they were wrong is that the U.S. went from rough trade balance, trade surplus in the early 90s to now a $500 billion deficit with the world, and it's concentrated in manufactured goods, and that has been hard on the manufacturing sector in this country. But we, even if we didn't have NAFTA, we would have a trade deficit of this order of magnitude, about $500 billion now. Our trade deficits with Canada and Mexico are much less proportion to our trade than they are with the rest of the world.
Rob, let's turn to you. There isn't any real agreement over how many jobs have been lost. And you heard Gary say that he's not even sure that job loss has to do with NAFTA. What do you say?
Well, we say that NAFTA was a trade and investment agreement. It helped spur the movement of factories from the U.S. to Mexico and Canada. In fact, these trade deficits that Gary talked about have been growing rapidly, and NAFTA has been a big part of the problem. In 1993, NAFTA made up about 8% of our world trade deficit. By 2002, it had risen to about 19%. So NAFTA is a big and growing part of our problem, and my estimate is that we've lost about 879,000 jobs since 1993 due to growing trade deficits with these countries.
So you both have just outlined for us the problem with discussing this issue is that there's two very different opinions on what the problem is. Gary, you say that if there was no NAFTA at all, trade between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. would be about 80% the same. But then why have NAFTA at all?
But why have NAFTA at all? Well, I think the main reason is to accelerate the reform process in Mexico, both economic and political reform. And I think on that count, it has been a huge success.
Mm-hmm. And Rob, some people would say that it's been good only for really big companies like Walmart.
I think that's right. I think that the Fortune 500 are the companies that dominate investment in Mexico and Canada, and they are the ones who've seen the most benefits to their profits.
But, Rob, why isn't it a good thing that, as Gary mentioned, there are more jobs in Mexico and perhaps less immigrants crossing the border into the U.S. to look for work here?
Well, in fact, the opposite has happened. We've seen a huge surge in immigrants from Mexico who've been displaced, many of them from the farming sector in Mexico because they've been hurt by a tremendous drop in prices of corn imported largely from the United States. We've seen real wages fall in Mexico by about 10% overall. So Mexico has really suffered more perhaps than the United States under the NAFTA agreement. And I think Mexico needed a different kind of agreement, and we point to the European Union, which brought in Greece and Spain and Portugal in the 1980s in a way that raised living standards in those countries. It's a path we didn't choose to follow here.
Well, as I said at the outset, this is a topic on which you both have agreed to disagree.
Yes.
And so do many. And I'm sure in this, the 10th year anniversary of NAFTA, we'll be hearing more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Scott of the Economic Policy Institute and Gary Huffbauer of the Institute for International Economics. Well, the Bush-Cheney reelection team is keeping a low profile on the national stage, letting the Democrats duke it out while focusing Republican efforts on small local radio shows, most of which already cater to card-carrying Republicans. Why? Joining us on the line from Arlington, Virginia, is Bush campaign press secretary Terry Holt. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Well, is it true that you have not been on one nationally televised television issues show?
Well, as the president said, the campaign season will begin in its own time. That he's referring to the very visible dogfight that you see among the Democrats right now, but that really hasn't begun.
Well, it's sort of begun for you. Have you been on radio shows almost every day?
Oh, sure. And in fact, what you find with local talk radio is that 73% of people who listen to talk radio are registered voters. So this is a group of people that will be very active in the public debate over the next several months. And for us, I think it really boils down to talking to people as close to home as we can as part of our grassroots organization to keep the faithful apprised of the president's agenda and to make sure that we continue in the debate without getting into the everyday back and forth that you see in the democratic process.
And as some would say, without maybe having to answer questions that you don't want or need to answer right now.
Oh, well, certainly to the contrary. Mark Bernier asked me about whether or not it was important for the president to catch bin Laden before the campaign began. I mean, you know, these guys aren't pansies. They really know how to ask a tough question. But what we find is that we are not positioned against another Democratic candidate. And because their primaries haven't even begun yet, we feel like it's premature to engage in a debate with someone who may not even be the nominee for the Democrats in November.
Well, and as you know, President Bush may have to face someone who will ask him or interviewers will ask him if, for instance, he lied when he connected al-Qaeda to Iraq through the Nigerian yellow cake in his statement in the State of the Union address, or was he lied to by his advisors, or when it comes to the economy, why are the very wealthy seeming to spend money and those in the lower class not having any money to spend? Why isn't the rising tide lifting all boats? I'm quoting from some of the articles recently, and I know you've heard these criticisms. Is this an effort to protect the president from those questions?
No, not at all. And in fact, we're going to have a full range of debate issues when the campaign begins between the president and his opponent, but I can't stress this enough. We don't know who his opponent will be yet. And to get engaged with 9 or 10 other potential candidates at this point, I think for our campaign, it's a balance. We have to continue to promote the president's message, and at the same time, the president has to continue to do his job. I mean, in fact, I think most people would prefer the president focus on national security and on homeland security and on the economy rather than get into the back and forth of politics today.
Tell me a little bit more about this push that you're making for people who are already in your camp.
Well, what we've found over the last 20 years is that people have begun to make up their mind about which party they're in. It doesn't necessarily mean the country is more polarized, but it does mean that people start out with a predisposition to support one candidate or the other. And so as we go through this process, we want to make sure that we have a very motivated group of supporters out there who are going to help us compete when it comes down to crunch time in the fall. And part of our radio effort is to talk to people in their communities, to talk about local issues, and to relate the president's national message to something that's a little closer to home.
Terry Holt, thank you.
Thank you.
Terry Holt, the Bush-Cheney campaign press secretary, he spoke to us from Virginia. Just ahead, we'll check in with a high school band in the middle of the Rose Bowl parade. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on Monday, we told you about the Londonderry Lancers, the high school marching band from Londonderry, New Hampshire, one of the few high school marching bands from outside of California to play in today's Tournament of Roses parade. Well, the 240 band members have made it past the hundreds of cameras at TV Corner. They had to do a tricky 105-degree turn around a big bend in the road. And joining us now from the parade route in Pasadena, California, is Lancers band director Andy Susie. Andy, how are you?
We're doing just fine. We're in the middle of a very grueling parade. The kids are doing a good job. They're holding up well, and everyone's enthusiastic.
Well, did the kids make it around that turn okay in formation? That was a tough one.
It is not only a tough one, it's so unusual because it's 105 degrees, and it slopes downhill as you go around. And there's not another site that I can find to practice that thing. But the kids did a nice job. You know, they hung in there, and I stayed in the corner for the entire band going around. And I thought they did very well. I was happy with them.
We heard your rehearsal, as you know, in your gym, and we were sweating it out for you. By the way, we want to know, did the sousaphones do that special flip they'd practiced?
Say that again on the last part?
Did the sousaphones do that special flip turn they were practicing with the instrument?
Yeah, they do all kinds of choreography. They just like that kind of stuff. But, no, they're doing fine. Everybody, they're still playing like crazy. They haven't stopped.
Well, Andy, we know you're going to have to play for 2.5 hours straight, and there are about 325 million people watching. So, you know, Happy New Year, and don't be nervous.
Well, listen, Happy New Year to you, and you're so kind to catch up to us, and we wish you all a great year. Thanks again.
Well, just pay attention. Watch where you're going. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye now.
Andy Susie, music and band director at Londonderry High School in Londonderry, New Hampshire. He spoke to us live from what sounded like a quiet Rose Parade in Pasadena, California. Well, the biggest sports story of 2003 could have been the trade of Alex Rodriguez, a.k.a. A-Rod, from the Texas Rangers to the Boston Red Sox. But the deal for the six-time All-Star fell through for now, leaving the Sox to kiss and make up with shortstop Nomar Garciaparra, who would have been lost in the trade. Whoops. So what were the biggest sports stories of 2003, other, of course, than the Sox not getting into the World Series? Sorry, I can't help myself. We turn now to Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Hello.
Robin, how are you?
I'm just fine.
Good.
I think I'm over the Red Sox.
Come on, it's almost time to be excited about what they're going to do next year.
Well, I know, and as you know, there is a lot of excitement about that.
Absolutely.
But what were some of the other big stories in sports this year?
Well, you know, I come at this from a gigantic bias. I don't want to suggest that the collapse of the WUSA was the biggest sports story of the year,
But you think it was.
I would suggest that something's going on here. We've been watching the rise of women's sports, girls' sports and women's sports, for some time now, almost since Title IX came into existence. And we've got more women's team sports in the Olympics. We've got women's professional leagues. We've got all kinds of opportunities that were unimaginable 25 years ago. And now suddenly we're beginning to wonder, this isn't going to be an eternal growing thing. The WUSA suspended operations because they ran out of money and they just weren't attracting people and corporate support to the extent that they had hoped to do that. The WNBA has been not as successful as people thought it might be. Its audience isn't growing as much as people thought that it might. And the accusation has been, oh, it's just being held up by the National Basketball Association, and without Big Brother, it would never be able to, you know, survive on its own. So we may be coming into that kind of second stage, and that may be the beginning of a very big story indeed, to see what happens with women's sports on the pro level especially.
What other stories?
Well, as usual, the bowl championship series failed to produce a definitive champion.
Tell me about this. Why is this always so?
How much time have you got? it's not possible to talk about this in a brief period of time. Basically, the way that they determine which teams should face each other in the annual championship game, which rotates between the big bowls, is a computer looks at difficulty of schedule, wins, losses, all these other variables go in. And once again this year, it failed to pit what everybody thought was the number one team in the country against the number two team in the country. And so everybody gets to pick their own best team in the country instead of having a definitive champ, which is, of course, the result when you have a tournament, say, like the NCAA basketball tournament.
Well, I can't help it. It comes back to the Red Sox for me and for many, because the Red Sox offseason, we of course mentioned the Nomar A-Rod business, but the Red Sox offseason has been so fascinating aside from that.
Any offseason where one of the owners of the team sneaks in and out of cities to talk to people is a great offseason. you can't deny that. Beyond that, the Red Sox acquired the best available starting pitcher in Curt Schilling, although he's, you know, elderly by baseball standards. He is also coming off an injured season, but we cross our fingers, we hope for the best. And they acquired the best available relief pitcher in the offseason in Keith Faulk from Oakland. Somebody pointed out right after that was kind of a double-dip win. They not only improved themselves, they made Oakland a little worse. And Oakland is a competitor, at least in the American League, potentially in the American League Championship Series. So, yeah, I mean, you got to look on the bright side as far as those two acquisitions are concerned.
Sports fans might be asking, what does this mean for Pedro Martinez, the Red Sox ace previous to these trades?
Well, Pedro remains the Red Sox ace. I don't think there's any question about that. What it means potentially, if you're a Red Sox fan who is optimistic, is that Pedro doesn't have the pressure of winning every time he goes to the mound, because if he doesn't win, Curt Schilling will win the next day, and that'll be okay. And the second thing it means is that probably the end of the bullpen by committee idea. Keith Faulk is a legitimate reliever, and it probably means that Pedro won't be left on the mound when everybody in the country thinks he should come off the mound, because there will be no worry about who might come in to relieve him.
You just reminded me again.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that awful. Left too long on the mound. Bill, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and thanks for having me on the show.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game.
New England holds its breath from summer into fall. Our Sox climb to first place and then blow it all.
Wait until next year. Oh, it is next year. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak to author Michael Pollan about mad cow disease and the meat on your table. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
All you Red Sox fans across the USA.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the Israeli-Palestinian roadmap to peace, suicide bombings, barriers, of course, a territory treacherous for inhabitants, challenging for reporters.
To be very frank, I'm exhausted. This is a very difficult story to work on. Journalists are one of the few people who really inhabit the territory of the middle, which is to say, to go and listen sympathetically to people on both sides on a regular basis.
Also, the story of mezzo-soprano Jan Curtis. For a time, a stroke took her ability to speak, but she could sing. These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. President Bush spent New Year's morning hunting quail with his father in Texas. Rain and foggy weather set the president's schedule back slightly. The president is having lunch with his father and several others, including U.S. Envoy James Baker, who recently returned from a lobbying trip to Asia. It's been a peaceful New Year in the United States, with millions gathering without incident in New York's Times Square and other major cities to celebrate the arrival of 2004. But the new year began with violence in Iraq with an attack on a popular restaurant. Lourdes Navarro reports.
A deadly car bombing at a popular Baghdad restaurant has left 8 people dead and 35 more injured. As rescue workers tried to look for survivors, overnight more bodies were found beneath debris, raising the death toll. The U.S. military says the car that exploded next to Nabil restaurant as a New Year's Eve party was underway was packed with 500 pounds of explosives. The blast collapsed half of the building and ripped through neighboring apartment blocks. It has also raised fears in an already tense capital of more attacks to come on soft targets. Among those injured were 3 reporters from the L.A. Times and 5 of its local staff members. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
6 presidential candidates have been certified to receive checks from the Federal Election Commission. Democrat Wesley Clark receives the most, $3.7 million, followed closely by Joe Lieberman, John Edwards, Dick Gephardt, Lyndon LaRouche, and Dennis Kucinich. The payments, totaling more than $15 million, are less than half the amount doled out to candidates during the same period in the last presidential election in 2000. The payments come from taxpayer contributions checked off in the 1040 tax returns. Pope John Paul hopes the new year brings an end to violence and a beginning to new respect for human dignity. The Pope marked World Day of Peace this morning at the Vatican. The pontiff renewed his call for peace between Israelis and Palestinians and offered prayers for the Vatican's ambassador to Burundi, who was killed recently in the violent African nation. A massive rally for democracy in Hong Kong today. Tens of thousands of people marched demanding full democracy for the former British colony. It was the biggest demonstration since a mass protest last summer that threw the government into crisis. Hundreds of thousands of people are celebrating the New Year's in Pasadena today as the 115th Annual Tournament of Roses Parade is underway. Many people have been camped out since yesterday to ensure a good view of the parade. Security along the parade route is tight, with more than 1,000 federal and local law enforcement officers on duty. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is off today. It's Here and Now. One step forward, 2 steps back, and then forward, and then back again. That was the Israeli-Palestinian roadmap to peace in 2003. Throughout the year, we've spoken frequently to Cameron Barr, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, and Cameron joins us from his home in Jerusalem. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, and nice to be with you, and yet I know what a tough topic. Can you just graph for us, as you look back for the year,
some of the prominent highs and lows.
Like a lot of years in the Middle East, there have been some notable lost opportunities here. I suppose the thing that comes to my mind first is the Palestinian experiment with having a prime minister at the top of their government, sort of under Yasser Arafat, but acting as a kind of as an alternative to Yasser Arafat. And that was in the person of a man named Mahmoud Abbas, who lasted for about 6 months before he was brought down, you know, in a way because of internal Palestinian political machinations, but also because of the lack of support he received in his, you know, efforts to kind of resurrect a negotiated track, the lack of support he received both from the Americans and from the Israelis.
Especially sad in light of the fact that he pledged, or his statement at the Jordan summit, the armed intifada must end. It's surprising he didn't get more support.
Well, exactly. I mean, he seemed to be just what the doctor ordered. But on both sides of this conflict, here at the end of the year, we're just where we were at the beginning of the year, where the leaderships in particular are divided about what they want. We have a lot of rhetoric about a commitment to a negotiated solution. We're hearing some just now at the end of the year from the Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon. But on the ground and on the street, which is sort of the Palestinian expression for public opinion, you get something different.
And you mentioned some sort of, you know, some shifts at the end of the year as it draws to a close. It makes me think immediately of Deputy Prime Minister Olmert and his comments. In contradiction to Sharon's, his good friend, and Olmert again is a hawk, that in fact the biggest threat facing Israel now, and correct me if I've got this, you know, wrong, is the numbers game, the maintaining the Jewish majority.
Exactly. I mean, that is really one of the high points of this year, that you find at the end of this year a greater level of debate and a greater recognition in Israel that they are losing the demographic war, even if they are winning the battles of this intifada. And they are certainly winning on the military front. I mean, the Palestinians, even though there's no ceasefire in place, have in some ways put down their arms. I mean, there are people trying to carry out attacks, but the number of those attempts is way down.
And by the way, Cameron, some would say that the attacks are down because of the fences.
True. I mean, and numerous Israeli targeted killings, as they say, assassinations of Palestinian leaders and also operatives, militants, terrorists, to use the Israeli word, you know, this is having some effect. But we do find in Israel at this stage, it's greater recognition that at some point in the next few years, there will be born between the Mediterranean and the Jordan the first Palestinian of the Palestinian majority. And that's a troubling recognition for most Israelis because, you know, Israel has wrestled with this dilemma since the beginning, 1948. Control all the land, then what do you do about the people? Give the people political rights, then you lose the majority. So how to finesse that? And I think even on the right in Israel now, you have a greater number of people who are saying, look, we simply have to let go of the land in order to preserve Israeli democracy and a Jewish majority within that democracy.
Give the land to the Palestinian people so that they can live on it and preserve the majority in Israel proper. And I'm wondering, Cameron, how much have you felt the war in Iraq impact that thinking? I'm thinking that Israel is glancing at Iraq and realizing that, you know, if Iraq has a democracy, one person, one vote, Israel certainly can't afford not to also have it. And as you said, can't afford to have it if the Palestinians are the majority.
Well, exactly. But, it's, you know, at this stage with Saddam Hussein in custody and the resistance or the insurgency continuing, I think it's pretty hard to guess how that's going to play out and who really benefits from the American situation in Iraq. Although it is absolutely true that Iraq is a distraction for the Americans, so that now the level of American engagement in this conflict is way down, and that's because people are frying bigger fish in Iraq.
Just before we leave the topic of Iraq's impact, how do you see it impacting the Palestinian people? We had one observer remark that Saddam Hussein was their biggest benefactor, so this might be shifting their strategies as well, the fact that he's definitely gone.
The symbolism of it all is a little bit more important than any sort of practical benefit that some may have provided. I mean, to see one of the staunchest, most stalwart Arab leaders come out of a, you know, what's now been described as a rat hole, that was tough for some Palestinians, I think. People were very surprised that he went without a fight. And at the level of symbolism is where that matters most.
It's always dangerous to look ahead in any news story, and especially this one. But I'm going to ask you to anyway. What do you see in 2004?
Well, I see continued stasis until we see a change in the leadership on both sides.
Cameron, one last personal reflection before we let you go. You appeared on Here and Now a couple of months ago with your wife, Nicole, who's also a journalist with The Monitor. And you were talking about living in and covering the Middle East, trying to raise a family there. And I'm glancing over some of the timeline that I have before me, that horrific Palestinian suicide bombing on the bus in August, in which so many children were killed and 100 were wounded, right in the heart of Jerusalem. And then again in June, the teenage suicide bomber dressed as an Orthodox Jew, killing 16 people. And I wonder, you're now moving stateside. You're going to be reporting for The Washington Post. I hope we can talk to you again at that point. But what are your thoughts as you leave Jerusalem?
To be very frank, I'm exhausted. This is a very difficult story to work on. It's very difficult. Journalists are one of the few people who really inhabit the territory of the middle, which is to say, to go and listen sympathetically to people on both sides on a regular basis and try to represent it fairly and accurately and sympathetically in the newspaper. So personally, I'm tired, and I'm looking forward to a chance to do something else for a while. And I also feel, as I was saying, that there isn't really a chance for a breakthrough here until we see a shift, maybe a generational shift, at the top on the two sides. I mean, I would come back under those circumstances to cover this story again. But for the time being, I'm happy to leave it to others.
One can only imagine, and you don't have to imagine, how the people who live there feel. Cameron,
exactly.
Yeah, Cameron, thank you so much, and thank you for your reporting during the year.
Sure, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Cameron Barr, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from his home in Jerusalem, soon to be a reporter for the Washington Post. He'll be living in suburban Washington. Still to come, the story of Jan Curtis, a mezzo-soprano who fought her way back from a stroke to sing again. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag to air some of your thoughts. Stan Duncan wrote presciently after our Monday D.C. roundtable. We had asked, whatever happened to the story of Valerie Plame, the outed CIA operative? Of course, later in the week, it was suddenly on the front pages as Attorney General John Ashcroft recused himself from the ongoing Plame investigation. But before that happened, listener Stan wrote, your roundtable contributor David Shribman said the Plame story is destined to become just a footnote in history. Then suddenly David changed the subject. I want to say that, respectfully, the only reason why this kind of story could become a footnote is if the press allows that to happen. This is a major event. What excuse does the press have for allowing silence on a major offense that endangered the life of a respected intelligence operative? Well, our recent editorial roundtable featuring Wall Street Journal editor Dorothy Rabinowitz brought a lot of responses. Dorothy said, among other things, that it was okay with her that President Bush does not read newspapers. He considers them too editorial. Well, Peter Cohen writes, I'm sure that President Bush doesn't get his news from NPR. At least one small blessing of his self-imposed ignorance is that he is spared the inane comments of Dorothy Rabinowitz. Well, the Wall Street Journal was at the heart of another roundtable. We talked to Wall Street Journal associate editor Melanie Kirkpatrick about the late legendary editor Robert Bartley, who often reported rumors, including one that then-presidential candidate Michael Dukakis had psychological problems. Melanie implied that the rumor eventually became a fact, prompting listener Alice Pierce to write, the statement that Michael Dukakis had a history of mental instability is absolutely false. I think it's critical for you to make that correction ASAP. Point taken, Alice. According to some reports, the rumors were circulated by supporters of Lyndon LaRouche and were absolutely not true. Speaking of corrections, David Wright of Wellesley, Massachusetts, reminds us that the name of the former New Jersey governor who heads the 9/11 Commission is Thomas Kane, even though it looks like Thomas Keene. And many astute listeners wrote and called after our interview with folk critic Scott Alaric. That's folk critic, not scientist. Scott said in the piece that the winter solstice is when the earth is farthest from the sun, prompting Paul Langer of Wayland, Massachusetts, to say,
"It is the opposite. It's the furthest from the truth. The sun is farthest from the earth on July 2nd. It is nearest the earth on January 2nd, give or take a day. And around Christmas time, it's almost as near as it can get. The reason things are cold has to do with the tilt of the earth's axis, not with the distance from the sun."
And finally, Julia McCurdy writes, "What is the name of the song which was referred to as a winter melody? I'm dying to listen to it again." Well, Julia, hold on. It's called "To Warm the Winter's Night," and it's by Onya Minogue. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your town and your full name. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Many of us try to make changes in our lives on New Year's Day, or try to come to terms with how our lives have changed. We thought one inspiration might be the story of mezzo-soprano Jan Curtis of Newton, Massachusetts. Jan had a 20-year career performing around the country, but after a stroke in 1995, she was left with partial paralysis and aphasia, a severe loss of speech. But Jan could still sing notes, and after a tremendous amount of work, added lyrics. She was finally able to perform, singing at a concert in Jordan Hall in Boston. She also appeared in a documentary about people dealing with the loss of the ability to use words. When we talked to Jan Curtis and her voice teacher, Sharon Daniels, back in March of 2002, we began by asking her how her speech works after the stroke.
Slow.
It works slow.
Really slow.
I think I just heard what your friends are now calling Janograms.
Yes.
That you get right to the point quickly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you can speak now mostly in those, you know, very quick telegraphed
right.
thoughts.
But short sentence.
Can you explain what it's like when you go to speak to me? Do you have a thought and you can't get it?
Struggle.
And you struggle to get it.
Struggle. Yeah. Struggle. No hope. Oh.
That's what it feels like.
To yeah.
Try. But it's not, you have the thought, you just can't make it come out.
Yeah. Can't do it.
Yeah. Gesturing to your mouth. But what happens when there's music playing? Does it free you to sing? How does that work?
I don't know. Free up.
Yeah.
Vocal waves. odd.
It's really a miraculous, weird phenomenon of the human mind, that the musical side of her brain was completely untouched and, in fact, maybe enhanced, because now she has so much need to communicate and uses it. But the pitch center was not touched, the rhythmic center, the discernment of style and of quality and all the aesthetic is amazing.
So when you heard the music, could you hear the lyrics in your head initially?
Oh, yeah.
And just not be able to sing them initially?
Yes. Right.
And then that came back before your speech really did?
Slow, yes.
She could sing text before.
Right.
She could say it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't odd?
We have some of the music that you've recorded since regaining your speech while singing. In particular, a song that's called Weeping Mary.
Oh, yes.
Let's hear a little of that. You have hand over heart, Jan. What does music like that, I'd call it more...
Weeping Mary, Catholic.
What does that mean to you?
Hold up the Catholic Church means more than life.
I know that your faith
pulls
you through. And you'd actually turned to your faith before you had the stroke. You had some other challenges in life. You've spoken of it. Had a problem with alcohol. Got a degree and were counseling others who had survived various challenges in life, everything from rape and incest to AIDS. So you were doing all of this before you even had the stroke. Nice safety net to have, I would imagine.
She also had just completed your master's in theology, from BC, just months before.
Well, it's one thing to sing the hymns and the gospel music, but you also sing some very difficult music. We have a piece of Ives that you performed at Jordan Hall.
Yes. Yes.
Before we hear it, what is the particular challenge for someone not only singing this music, but speaking lyrics in a modern piece like Ives?
Well, complicated fascia. Easy, how I say that?
For someone who has easy speech.
Easy speech.
The music itself is technically difficult.
Right.
The intonation, the rhythmic structure, etc. For Jan, it's a particular challenge. That part seemed to be right there. But the challenge is to get the text to happen on the rhythmic moment that it's supposed to happen.
Right, right.
Just because it's very, it's cumbersome to get the glides and the...
Yes.
Let's hear some of that Ives recording. It is Ives' Remembrance. Were you there? Are you hearing it in your head and trying to make your muscles work?
No. Easy.
Muscles are easy. Is it the mouth?
Strength.
Stomach strength.
Yeah.
It's still so lovely.
Oh, good.
No, you know you got tremendous reviews. I have in front of me Lloyd Schwartz, who's the noted classical music reviewer. I was trying to describe your voice, the texture of your voice, and of course, he did it better, no surprise. Her distinctively coppery, expressive voice still carries to the back row, still opens like a blossom at the top.
Ooh.
That's pretty nice.
That must have been, what did you feel like going on stage after having struggled for so long, this expectation of what you might do, and the difficulty still in doing it?
Oh, doing it. Concentration.
I would imagine the fact that it's so much easier for you to speak when you're singing You must want to just sing all the time.
Not true.
No. To communicate better? To
aphasia, it hard. It really hard.
Well, Jen, some of the music that you performed in the concert in Boston included some you'd already written. I was struck by the title of the passage we're going to hear. It's called Disillusioned, and it's from your piece, Transformations.
Right.
What were you thinking of when you wrote this?
Catholic.
Was it a different time? It was
right.
A different time in her life
right.
when her faith was very new and important.
Let's hear a little of that. Strikes me, you wrote this before you even had the stroke.
Yeah.
And long ago.
And how it seems to apply to someone.
Yes.
Did you feel that? I don't know who I am if I don't sing. Or, you know, I mean, did you question your faith?
Oh, whoa.
Probably all of the above. Right.
Right.
Yeah, everything.
But tell me about that, Jan. I mean, could you conceive of yourself not singing?
No. Heavens.
There was a period of time, though, that you decided it was too hard. There was maybe almost a year that she didn't want to sing.
Can't do it.
Yeah. Right at the beginning, right soon after when she first went into rehab, we started.
Right.
What changed your mind?
Faith. Well, try harder.
Unbelievable grit, this woman.
Yeah. Right on.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jan, thank you so much. And Sharon as well. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating story. I thought I was going to be talking to someone about keeping up the singing, but it's obviously about keeping up the faith.
Yep.
A reprise of our conversation with mezzo-soprano Jan Curtis and Sharon Daniels, Associate Professor of Music at Boston University. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Brad Fritz, Jordana Gustafson, Sarah Cook, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Special thanks and happy trails to our interns, Ann Stevenson and Ed Walters. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll speak with author Michael Pollan about mad cow disease and the beef on your plate. And the fat film. Our movie panel weighs in on why so many movies these days are way too long. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.